This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
In September 2016, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services issued its final rule on clinical trials registration and results information submission, which has potentially broad implications for the clinical research enterprise. Today, we're going to explore some of those implications. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of the DIA Global Forum. Today, I am speaking with Dr. Marla Jo Brickman, Senior Director for Clinical Data Transparency and Compassionate Access Lead at Pfizer. Dr. Brickman serves on the program committee for DIA's Clinical Trial Disclosure and Data Transparency Conference, where she will chair the session, Sharing Patient-Level Data. Where are we headed? Welcome, Dr. Brickman, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Would you briefly summarize for us the main points of this new HHS final rule?
When the rule came out, there were three or four main changes that were implemented. One was the requirement now to post results of studies on non-marketed, non-approved compounds. Another was for study sponsors to post their final protocol statistical analysis plan when they have to post the results for their studies. The third was a mechanism to clearly identify applicable clinical trials upon study registration. And a fourth was to create an expanded access record for any product that the study sponsor is making available through an expanded access mechanism at their company.
So your opinion, what are the most positive aspects of this final rule, and are any aspects troublesome or challenging in any particular way?
Having the ability for study sponsors to clearly define their studies that are applicable clinical trial is quite positive. Many study sponsors, you know, including my company, Pfizer, register and post results for trials that go beyond the scope of the law. And we've seen in the literature over the past few years, folks who are doing analyses of compliance and without a correct denominator as to what's in scope of the law, a lot of times those analyses provide an incorrect or an inaccurate read on what sponsors are actually doing. So I think having that flag for applicable clinical trial is going to be very strong and allow anyone who wants to do an analysis to really see what sponsors are doing in regard to the U.S. law. In terms of troublesome, I think it's a little too early to tell with regard to registration. Results reporting, we're looking to see what posting protocol and statistical analysis plans will look like. Those will likely not really get started until the end of the year into next January when that aspect of the law goes into effect. So I think we're waiting to see how that mechanism plays out.
Did I hear you say that the rule provides a clearer definition of applicable clinical trials and therefore presumably industry will have an easier time identifying the denominator number that you refer to?
Yes. I think right now what the rule allows is for study sponsors to flag. There's, if you will, like almost a checklist to flag a study that falls within scope of an applicable clinical trial. So anyone external can look to see those studies and identify the studies that have those flags to say like, okay, this is in scope with the FDA and the final rule law, and therefore they're required by law to be registered and have results posted. Studies that don't have the flag are studies that study sponsors have chosen to voluntarily register and or post results, you know, beyond the scope of the law. So I think this is a good aspect of the final rule.
Can you give us an example of an applicable trial and a non-applicable trial under the rule?
You know, a non-applicable trial is one that's not conducted in the United States, that doesn't use a product that's manufactured in the United States, that is not controlled. So again, you know, an applicable clinical trial, you know, has to have at least one study site in the United States. The product has to be manufactured in, or parts of it, or at least parts of it have to be manufactured in the United States. It has to be a controlled clinical trial. So those are aspects of what defines applicable versus non-applicable.
You made reference to some cross-border considerations here, U.S. versus non-U.S. trials. So let me ask you, what are the similarities and possibly differences between this final rule in the United States and the new European Medicines Agency policy on publishing clinical data?
So with regards to the U.S.-EU differences, currently study results are required to be posted on the European website, EudraCT, 1 year after study completion for adult trials and 6 months after study completion for pediatric trials. And these are without regard to the marketing status of the drug and, you know, being studied. So the U.S. final rule now, if you will, aligns with that timing, not the pediatric aspect, but the non-marketed aspect of it. Because prior to the implementation of the final rule in the United States, we only had to post study results after the product was approved by the FDA. So now, as I said previously, we're going to be posting results for non-approved products, and that's going to be aligned in the U.S. and the EU. What the EU requires in the Policy 70 is for clinical reports that are contained within a marketing authorization application to have the clinical reports, the study reports, other clinical documents in the application made publicly available on their site. And the difference is the EMA, the European Medicines Agency, really has a strong hand in determining what information can and cannot be redacted in those documents. So study sponsors have to submit the documents with what they want redacted, whether it's personal information of the patient or even commercially confidential information. And the EMA then sort of judges or weighs in as to what they will accept and not accept. And I believe, you know, their decision is binding unless there's very strong pushback and there may be some consultation. But my understanding is the EMA's decision is binding. So in terms of the EMA, you're getting the full study report. You're getting the full clinical reports that are part of the submission that will be out there in the public domain upon the marketing authorization. In the U.S., what you're going to have available are the protocol statistical analysis plan when we post the results. And the U.S. is not dictating what can and cannot be redacted. They basically said, the final rule basically said that the information that is required to have results posted, such as your primary and secondary endpoints, cannot be redacted, but have given very little guidance as to what other information may be allowed to be redacted. And what, you know, as of what I know, there's going to be no review of those documents when they get posted.
So for someone like yourself who works on clinical data transparency, presumably every day, do these two rules make your life easier, more complicated, clearer, less clear? What is your take on the implications of these rules for the everyday life of someone like yourself in this particular field of regulatory and clinical?
So I think initially it makes it a little more complicated because you have to go through the rule and, you know, read all the legal aspects of it, and then you have to implement it. So there is some level of looking at your own internal company policies and SOPs and processes and procedures, and ensuring that they're aligned with what we are now required to do legally. So I think initially there are a few more headaches, but then once things get rolled out, it just becomes business as usual.
Coming now to the DIA conference on clinical trial disclosure and data transparency, where you will have a session on sharing patient-level data, mm-hmm. Would you preview some of the topics that you will discuss in your own session, and maybe more broadly, what will be covered in the conference?
The session is still being developed. I'm still trying to identify a speaker or two, but we are currently looking at, you know, a broader view of what data sharing is about. I have a speaker potentially from the VIVLI, the Harvard MRCT program, to come to speak about what that initiative is about. And I also have a speaker who planned to come speak from the FDA, who is the founder of the Information Exchange and Data Transformation, or INFORMED, initiative. So again, I'm trying to broaden the scope of data sharing to have different voices come and speak to that topic. Some of the other topics at the program, you know, we're going to have some of the regulators from both the U.S. and the EU come to speak about the final rule and the EU laws, and those tend to be very informative sessions, and we learn a lot from, you know, the regulators themselves. There's going to be sessions on, you know, preparing documents for a disclosure, because, you know, many of the attendees, you know, are doing this day to day, and, you know, having any sort of insight as to how we make it work easier, more streamlined, is really appreciative. And we're also doing some short courses before the start of the official program. One is going to be sort of like a disclosure 101, because there's constantly new people entering into the disclosure world. So we're trying to have that as an introductory course as to what, you know, clinical trial disclosure is about. And then another one about preparation of documents. And this year, I think I'm really excited about it. We actually solicited abstracts and presentations from, you know, the wider community. And we're going to have a session of abstracts and presentations from folks who are now part of the planning committee. I think it's great. I think it gives an opportunity to give other people who are in the community a chance to step up and participate in a more thorough way.
With regard to sharing patient-level data, obviously this can be a very sensitive thing to do. Is there any new thinking in relation to this particular area of clinical research? Anything that could stimulate people to think differently about sharing patient-level data?
I don't know if there's any new thinking. I think it's gotten to the point where people now are accepting it. At Pfizer, we've been sharing data. We've been up and running since December 2013. We've already had numerous requesters complete their analyses and have either abstracts submitted and presented at, you know, international symposium and or, you know, peer-reviewed journal articles. So I think we're now getting to the point, not only at my company, but at other companies who are sharing data, researchers are getting their presentations and their manuscripts, and the benefit of the data sharing is really becoming more prevalent and obvious. I think that's what's exciting is before, when it was started, people weren't quite sure what to make of it. And now we're seeing the fruits of those past couple of years where we're getting some good science out there as a result of this data sharing initiative.
That brings us to the end of our conversation today. Dr. Brickman, thank you very much for your time and insights.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with me. And I hope I see many folks at our conference in September.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.